Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. It's been almost a quarter century since television's most famous cartoon family so aptly summarized the cultural attitude towards vegetarianism and veganism, or as we're calling it now, the plant-based lifestyle.
I'm trying to impress people here, Lisa. You don't win friends with salad.
You don't win friends with salad. You don't win friends with salad.
You don't win friends with salad.
As usual, The Simpsons did a memorable job speaking for the masses of the time, but that was a long time ago. Today, there's no question that the prevailing attitude towards veganism has shifted dramatically. It's now hailed as an ethical approach to eating, a personal way we can all tackle climate change. Some of the most exclusive restaurants in the country have vegan menus or are totally plant-based. Health Canada is currently in the middle of rewriting the Canadian Food Guide. And early prototypes show a section labeled protein, replacing what used to be meat and dairy. Is this the result of a vocal minority advocating for their lifestyle to be acknowledged? Or is the way we eat, all of us, changing? And if the way we eat is changing, what happens to everything that surrounds it? Restaurants, dinner parties, grocery chains, and farmers? And can things like Meatless Mondays really make a difference? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. I am not a vegan, and our guest, Julie Van Rosendahl, is not either. She is, however, a longtime food writer and editor. Her work appears in the Globe and Mail, her voice appears on CBC Radio, and also on her new podcast called Crispy Bits. Why don't we just start by, you can tell me, you've been in the restaurant and food business for a long time. When and how did you first encounter veganism?
You know, when I was a kid, I'm in my late 40s for perspective. So in the 70s and 80s, I remember, you know, some of my friends' parents being vegan, and it was super fringe. You know, it was really sort of rare for people to go down to the one sort of health food store downtown in Calgary and seek out these special ingredients like tofu and yogurt, and they, you know, like they grew sprouts in their windowsill, and it was super, like, you know, really out there, especially in Alberta, for people to be
right.
Not only vegetarian but vegan, you know. So it's something that I've been aware of since I was a kid, but it's definitely changed over the decades.
Yeah, that's kind of why we wanted to talk to you, because you've been witness to kind of most of it, being so involved in the food industry. How has the perception shifted from just even the stereotypical image of a vegan from back then to now?
I mean, over the years, our perception of veganism has changed hugely, but it's been very gradual until I feel like in recent years, it's really the sort of plant-based eating has really taken an upswing. And partly, I think that's due to social media. It's due to the availability of ingredients. I'm not a vegan myself. I do like meat, but I don't eat a whole lot of it. It's the cheese and the butter that I would have a hard time with.
Right.
And it's those ingredients that, you know, it used to be really tricky to seek out. Things like, you know, rice milk or quinoa. You know, we saw the rise of quinoa just a few years ago. The vegan cheese, all these ingredients that in the past have been really hard to source have become more readily available. And ideas have spread through social media. Instagram has been a huge push for veganism and plant-based eating.
How so?
Because people get new ideas, right? I mean, it sort of opens up your community beyond the Moosewood cookbooks, which were sort of a staple of the 70s and 80s and 90s. There is sort of a handful of vegetarian and vegan cookbooks that had these little, tips and tricks to getting enough protein or, you know, alternatives to cheese, and that sort of community has blown open so that, you know, you can tap into resources worldwide. You can talk to other people, you know, on the other side of the world. You can see these great grain bowls and solutions to, you know, making cheese or egg replacers or, you know, how to bake. So the access to information, I think, has been huge for people who are focused on plant-based eating. And even just the sort of rebranding of veganism as plant-based eating, it's being approached in a different way. So there isn't that sort of stigma that I feel like it's had for a long time. I even have vegan friends myself who don't like being referred to as vegan, but prefer to call it plant-based eating.
And what's the difference to a non-vegan in those terms? I mean, I know they're intended to mean the same thing.
They are. They do mean the same thing. So I feel like the term veganism sort of comes with a really strict idea of, you know, what that entails. In fact, I think for non-vegans, a lot of people have a hard time understanding exactly what veganism is. It seems very extreme. It seems kind of radical to a lot of people who aren't familiar with that sort of way of eating. In fact, I know a lot of people mistake gluten-free sort of with veganism, and they kind of put the two together. We had some good friends of ours are vegan, and one of them was in the hospital. They have four kids, and so we had this big vegan potluck to bring food to the hospital as well to his family, and so many people who came said, oh, you know, I found this gluten-free flour, and I substituted, you know, this gluten-free, and so that's sort of a misperception about veganism and plant-based eating. But I think it sort of it puts veganism in a new light. You know, when you call it plant-based, it sort of sounds more like, okay, that's, you know, that's really what we're talking about, is eating plant-based foods, you know, not only no meat, but, you know, dairy products. A lot of people who are vegan don't eat honey. And then beyond that, vegan products as well, right? Vegan boots and vegan handbags. And so it's more a lifestyle. But that sort of plant-based, I feel like it takes the edge off a little bit for people who think of it as a sort of hardcore lifestyle.
Yeah. And you mentioned how difficult it used to be to find those vegan ingredients.
Yeah.
In the restaurant industry, I feel like, well, I don't know. Have you ever been to a place in Toronto called Vegandale?
I know of Vegandale. I haven't been to it, but I know of Vegandale, which is like a neighborhood that's sort of devoted to veganism.
Right. And what fascinates me about that is that it's economically viable enough now to have a small neighborhood that is devoted entirely to the vegan lifestyle. And, you know, presumably this wouldn't be happening if there were no money for the proprietors to be made here.
No. And you know what I find is really interesting about this whole rise of veganism and plant-based eating? I said a while ago that I think there's more vegan cookbooks out there than there are vegan people. Because there are so many. I mean, the biggest selling cookbooks, you know, Oshi Glows and Thug Kitchen, are these plant-based books. But the interesting thing about the popularity of the neighborhoods and the cookbooks and the restaurants is that not everybody who consumes them or visits them or uses them are committed to a vegan lifestyle, right? So you see even people who won't make the full-time commitment to veganism using the cookbooks and visiting the restaurants and going to the neighborhoods. And partly it's because they have a broader appeal now than I feel like they used to. It used to be sort of the kind of hippie establishments where, you know, everything would be sort of based on beans and very kind of hardcore. You kind of had to be part of that community to feel comfortable there. And now you have these restaurants, you know, like Love in Montreal and Rosalinda in Toronto, just opened by the owners of Bar Isabel. And so they have the classic dishes that we want to go out into a restaurant and eat, like fried chicken and waffles and burgers and sort of plant-based versions of those foods that don't feel so sort of fringe and sort of out there for people who aren't committed to a plant-based lifestyle. So you can go, you know, it's not a matter of sort of going with your vegan friends, but bringing a whole group of people, no matter what they eat, and having them feel like they, you know, we'll find something on the menu that they like. But you also are seeing restaurants like the Earl's chain in Calgary. I know it's not as big out east, but they just rolled out a vegan menu. And other restaurants are becoming more plant-forward. I'm hearing that term a lot. Even if they do have meat on the menu, they're not sort of dedicated to plant-based or vegan you know, exclusively vegan dishes on the menu, but it's definitely swaying more towards sort of veggie heavy, and there might be, you know, two or three sort of meat proteins on the menu instead of mostly meat proteins with a few, you know, vegan options. To go back to your initial question, you know, how have things changed over the decades and the generations? I think it's a lot easier for people to be vegan or right. or plant-based, you know, because they can go to so many restaurants and find something on the menu that's delicious.
Up next.
Research has shown that cutting meat and dairy can reduce your carbon footprint. And so we see things like Meatless Mondays, you know, people who eat vegetarian or vegan one day a week. And those small changes do make a big impact.
We all have investment goals, and Scotia iTrade can help you reach yours. Access free tools and resources to sharpen your investment skills. Visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. Scotia iTrade, there's a trader in all of us. You probably know that Canada is currently redeveloping its food guide.
Yeah.
And they're, one of the things that is likely to happen is the elimination of kind of the meat and the dairy section in exchange for a general protein section,
among
other things. And it feels like, given that we're talking about the rise of veganism, and certainly there have been like a lot of pieces, one of the reasons we wanted to do this story is because we saw a ton of pieces about how 2019 was going to be the year of the vegan. It feels like whether or not it's totally a move to strict veganism, that the way we eat is changing.
Definitely the way we eat is definitely changing. Meat is, it used to be that the meat was sort of the centerpiece of the meal, you know, like this leading role.
Yeah.
And then the grains and the veggies were sort of the afterthoughts, you know, that sort of filled in the gaps on the plate. And now we're seeing even people who eat meat eat less of it. It's eaten more almost as a condiment, you know, as sort of a playing a minor role in soups and stews and curries and all these other dishes that have a lot more vegetables in them. And partly it's because we're realizing that the potential that vegetables have, you know, it wasn't that long ago that vegetables were brutally overcooked.
Yeah.
You look at old cookbooks, and I found an old cookbook that had a vegetable cooking chart in the front, and the cooking times range from about 40 minutes to 2 hours for fresh vegetables.
In the oven?
On the stovetop, in the oven, like boiled, simmered, steamed. And so, I mean, they were just cooked to death. And so I think, we're realizing now how to cook vegetables properly and what a wide variety of vegetables are out there. And a new appreciation for nuts and seeds and pulses. And for a long time, I mean, Canada grows tons of pulses, which, you know, lentils, chickpeas, brown or black beans, and hundreds of varieties of pulses. And Canadians have had a hard time wrapping their minds around what to do with them. And, you know, do you soak a bean? Do you have to cook it for a long time? And so beans haven't been a staple in our diets for a long time. And so we're sort of getting to understand the potential for those forms of protein as well.
As someone yourself who puts together cookbooks, who writes about food, who talks about food, and who also self-admittedly loves to cook for other people, how has your preparation in terms of putting together meals for guests and other people changed?
Well, I do love cooking for people, and you always have to, when you're cooking for people, take into account people's, you know, preferences and dietary needs and restrictions, and which I think is what makes people intimidated by the thought of inviting friends over for dinner. Dinner parties used to be huge, and now I feel like they're kind of people. There's this, you know, performance anxiety and all these different considerations to take into account.
We expect a lot more out of our food these days.
Well, and I think the bar has been raised so high because of, you know, so many competition shows and Food Network and you know, the sort of culinary superstars out there that I hear a lot of people say, oh, I can't cook. You know, they just expect so much of themselves, too much of themselves, I think. And you know, if anyone wants to invite me over for dinner, I'm not going to be critiquing their food. I'm there for the company and
right.
for the, you know, the people around the table. And so how it's changed for me is, you know, I do a lot of sort of one dish meals, I think, are easy when you're feeding a lot of people. And it's easy to accommodate a wider variety of dietary needs. You know, if you have someone who doesn't eat meat, it's easy to, you know, to do a big curry or a big vegetable stew or soups. And then you don't have to worry about all the different components of the meal, which I think can stress people out. And just having a big pot on the table, I think, is welcoming in itself.
What about the specifics of the rise of veganism? So we know, obviously, just anecdotally, that awareness is on the rise. But do we have any idea if more Canadians are actually going vegan or changing the way they eat?
So, yeah, there is a poll that was recently done that found little hard evidence of an increase, although we've seen in the UK it has skyrocketed. About 7% of the population in the UK considers themselves vegan or sort of plant-based full-time. And in Canada, there hasn't been a lot of research to sort of put the new numbers against. 2.3% of Canadians consider themselves vegans. 7.1% of Canadians are vegetarian. So certainly, you know, a lot of people are eating plant-based meals more often, whether they're committing to it full-time or not. But, yeah, we're definitely seeing a rise globally of people committing themselves to veganism. And partly as, you know, as a lifestyle, you know, like we talked about earlier, there are vegan festivals and there are vegan neighborhoods and there are vegan products. And so it's sort of a way that people identify themselves as more, you know, environmentally conscious, sort of trying to reduce their carbon footprint. And it's most often young people who are making this choice. So numbers show that people under 35 are more likely to be vegan than people over 35. But those sort of over 35 are definitely cooking that way more, you know, whether or not they're committing to it full time or calling themselves vegan or plant-based, they're definitely eating that way more often than they used to.
I'm also not a vegan, but I do find myself considering vegetarian options more often simply because I feel like there's so few things I can personally do in terms of climate change and the moral imperative I think we all feel. And this is one of them.
It's true. And it's something that we do every day. And so it's, you know, it's sort of a small thing that can make a global impact if we all sort of get behind it. And so, you know, research has shown that cutting meat and dairy can reduce your carbon footprint. And so we see things like Meatless Mondays, you know, people who eat vegetarian or vegan one day a week. And those small changes do make a big impact. So like you, I'm definitely, you know, eating more vegetables, more plant-based proteins, and with the sort of increase in products available and resources and cookbooks and websites and Instagram feeds, there's no shortage of inspiration. So, you know, there are interesting dishes everywhere that are easy to cook and they're affordable, and there isn't that sort of sense of loss when you bring a dish to the table and it doesn't have the, you know, the steak as the centerpiece or the pork chop as the main event. I think people are just sort of embracing this as a new way to eat.
What is your go-to vegan dish to bring somewhere? I'm putting you on the spot now, but we want inspiration.
Oh, well, you know, curries, I love doing curries because you can throw any kind of vegetable in there, and lentils and chickpeas. If I'm bringing it somewhere, you know, curries last for days, they get even better in the fridge. So you can make it ahead of time, you can transport it and reheat it. I love grainy salads, you know, with farro and barley and quinoa and different veggies. I like to bring a little side dish of cheese just for the non-vegans, you know.
Just to mess
so
up
I'll
the
do
vegans.
Like a grainy salad with chickpeas and, you know, tons of, you know, interesting veggies and, you know, nuts for crunch and whatever. And then a little side dish of feta for the people who just really love a little bit of cheese in their, you know, dish. But yeah, I would say a big curry or like a grainy salad with lots of pulses.
Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
Julie Van Rosendahl, food writer, food editor, food talker. Go listen to Crispy Bits wherever you get podcasts. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. And of course, we are at thebigstorypodcast.ca. We also, by the way, have some new social media handles. You can find us at Frequency Pods. That's where you'll find news from The Big Story, news from Black Tea, from The Legal Podcast, from many others. We've got a couple of new shows in store for you. And you can always find just us at The Big Story FPN on Twitter. And of course, we are always in every podcast app, everywhere, from Apple to Google to Stitcher to Spotify to your personal favorite. And we would love to hear from you. So please leave us a rating, leave us a review. Claire Broussard is our lead producer. Ryan Clark and Stephanie Phillips are our assistant producers. Megan Coley is our associate editor and our social media maven. I am Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening, and we will talk Monday.